On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Heather Beyer was 8 years into a New York career, lugging her briefcase, hitting her marks, doing the lunches, calming her boss, and hating it. It wasn't rich enough, deep enough, real enough, surely, to be her life, not nearly. Then one day, Heather Beyer, 30-something, career woman, 5'1", 102 pounds, stepped into a pool hall, and a second life began. Smoky, dark, a little dangerous, and just the real thing she was looking for. Pool sucked her in, taught her how to concentrate, taught her how to talk tough, how to size up big men and sharp women, how to live. It's quite a story. Up next on Point, how Heather Beyer got her groove back in the pool halls of New York City. Before this hour is out, we will hear from a real pro, Monica Webb, the number one ranked professional women's pool player in the country. They call her the assassin. But first, joining me from New York is Heather Beyer, adventure-seeking amateur pool player and author of the new memoir, Sweet, an Eight-Ball Odyssey. Heather Beyer, thanks very much for being with us.
I am here.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us. What was a girl like you doing in the pool halls of New York City?
That's a good question. One I'm sure my parents are still asking. I had looked at pool from afar for many years, just passing by, looking through windows, and never once did I think of actually venturing inside. But at a certain point in my life, I guess I was feeling particularly thwarted. I just decided to walk in one day and see if somebody could teach me. And I told no one I was going to do this. It was just this secret thing I thought I would try. And I was told I could. I walked into Chelsea Billiards on 21st Street in Manhattan, where I had seen men playing in the windows there. And I walked in one day and there was no one in there. It was completely empty and hushed, which was very appealing. And I asked the person working at the desk, is there someone here who could teach me? And she said, well, you can come to pool school, which is something I had never heard of. And I immediately started backtracking and saying, oh, well, I'm just a beginner. I don't really know how to play. And she said, oh, we take all levels. And I said, no, really, I don't know how to play. Because at that point, I had never held a cue before. And so I did come back the next Monday. It was $5 an hour from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m.
For pool school.
And they have local sharks that work there in sort of various stages of, ascent and descent. And they get free table time and a place to keep their cue. And I was greeted by someone who escorted me to a table and said, all right, let's see what you got.
You hold this end and off you went. There's something very singular about going to pool, but there's something sort of universal about what was bugging you or what was insufficient in your life.
Yes.
You write early on in the book, you said you weren't quite ready to give up your careerist, fast-track life, no matter its frustrations, but you write that you yearned for another life, too. What I think I wanted, though I can't articulate it, is a double life, a parallel existence in which I can relax and be someone else. You were turning to pool for what? To round out the picture? It wasn't enough to have the big lunches and the resume?
I think it was not so much rounding out the picture. I think it was I was seeking some kind of refuge. I had a very high visibility job. I had to be on all the time. It was extremely verbal, a lot of rat-a-tat-tat.
You were bi-coastal in the feature film business, proposing film ideas all the time to the big boss in L.A.
Exactly. And was looking for ideas in New York City, you know, from books and from plays and from articles and something someone wrote on a cocktail napkin. And I had to go to bat every day and try and get somebody to say yes to one of these ideas. And it was a giant exercise in delayed gratification a lot of the times because it was very hard to get someone to say yes, but still I had to keep talking and to be on, and I had to be always very succinct. You got somebody's attention for 25 seconds, so I had to boil it down. There was very little complexity. And so, you know, walking by these pool halls and peering in, or even if I saw it on TV or if I was sitting in a bar watching it always from the sidelines, it seemed so antithetical to this. It was so still and so quiet and nonverbal. And it seemed, you know, I wasn't really sure what was going on in those tables, but it seemed very complex to me and nuanced. And initially, it started out as a refuge, as something that I would find soothing, you know, just a complete counterpart, you know, the yin to the yang of this sort of ridiculous life that I felt like I was living in New York City.
But it blossomed into a kind of second life, a second take on what goes on in the world, in the way people relate, in the way men and women relate, women and women, with some of the tough mamas you found at the pool tables.
What
did you, apart from the stillness, the complexity, the kind of attraction of the geometry of pool, what did you expect to find in pool halls? I mean, we're all sort of loaded with cultural expectations of what a pool hall means. What were your expectations about atmosphere, tone, people, before you really got into the grain of it?
I would say initially, I sort of wanted to be invisible. And it seemed to me that when you walked into a pool hall, this cloak immediately enveloped you because it was so quiet and there were just people sitting at the corners watching. And I just wanted to watch. I didn't want to be in the center.
But the cloak we think of is what? Cigarette smoke, the smell of beer and whiskey, maybe a little cloak of danger, even menace in the pool hall.
Yes.
Did you find that, or is that just Hollywood talking?
I did find that, actually. And I did have some preconceived notions because of Hollywood. And in fact, the irony that here I was working in the movie business and was not getting any atmospheric, dramatic, smoke-filled type movies made. And yet I had that idea about pool halls. And yes, it was there. And it was sometimes it was sort of under the surface. But it was... I did see instantly just the faces and the postures of the people in there were completely different than this sort of like crisp, buttoned-up world that I was in during the day. There was people were very – some of them were very relaxed. Some of them were very coiled. But it was just interesting to me that people physically held themselves differently. The rooms were always dark except for these little bursts of light over the table. So you would see just, you know, the flicker of people's faces. It was a very interesting way to look at people in New York City as opposed to bumping into them on the sidewalk or whatever. And I was very wide-eyed, and I just sucked it up. It was, you know, like I had been wandering in the desert and suddenly someone had offered me this great glass of water, you know, in the form of these characters in New York City pool halls. And I was very shy at first, and I was left alone. You know, it wasn't that I was, you know, I was able to watch. No one thought it was weird that I was in there, that someone would come in and be banging around on the tables and not say anything and just look around. I think that was accepted in a pool hall. And the longer I stayed, the more I wanted to know, and eventually was coaxed into being a part of it. And then it became very electric. Then it was, you know, sort of less about the quiet and more about the noise, you know?
We want to hear about that electricity. You were in films, and then you were in pool halls, and of course, films have a lot to do with the way we think about pool halls. There's one great film, The Hustler, Paul Newman, stars Eddie Felsen. 1961 kind of film noir. There's a little clip here. Since you came out of film, let's hear it, sort of get us in the pool mood. Here's Paul Newman as Felsen watching Minnesota Fats, played by Jackie Gleason, playing pool.
Great. Geez, that old fat man. Look at the way he moves like a dancer.
12, cross-eyed.
And those fingers, them chubby fingers. That stroke. It's like he's playing a violin or something.
Look at that fat man move like a dancer, says Paul
Newman
there. Jackie Gleason is Minnesota Fats. Did you get that kind of sense of people watching each other that closely with that kind of, you know, very tight assessment of everybody at the pool table? Is that where some of the electricity begins, sizing up the other guys and gals?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, that's a delicious scene to play. And it is true that there is something about pool, about the lines and the elegance of it, that when it is played well, even the biggest, schlumpiest guy or gal can look completely graceful. And when you play, I suppose in a way there is some similarity to looking for tells in poker, but you do become very attuned to your opponent and to yourself, and you watch every move, and it can help your game. I mean, you know, one of the things I do when I start to play someone is I try and assess, are they a fast player or a slow player? Because if they're fast, if they like to run the table, if they like to sink balls, I play slow. I play defensively.
Mess with their minds.
Exactly. And you watch another thing. This was actually a problem for me when I first started. I definitely suffered from performance anxiety, where I could play fine in the pool hall when I was practicing. And then when I was actually in a match and people were watching, I would get so nervous and my bridge hand would tremble just a little, just a teeny bit. But I knew
the bridge
that it was
hand,
just
that's the
enough.
One holding the end of the cue out there, not the
yes.
shover, but the holder, yep.
Exactly. You slide the cue mm-hmm. through your fingers and mm-hmm. enter in the bridge. And when I was placing it on the table to set up the bridge, there would just be this little tremble. And I knew that the other teammate, even though his or her expression would be completely blank, I knew they noticed it.
But you got in there. We'll hear more mm-hmm. about that. You got your own handle as you went along, the heathen, mm-hmm. no less you.
Yes.
What, 5'1", 102 pounds, the heathen, that's amazing.
Yes.
Heather Byard joins us from New York. And Heather, you found a whole world inside that pool hall realm. I wish you'd read a little bit for us, maybe from like page 108 there. You're talking about Paul and Gary and Trevor and a lot of the people that you found in the hall. We're going to hear from one of them in just a moment. But what they were looking for there, what they found there, what you were looking for there, could you read a bit for us?
Sure. There is no question that for Paul G. and Gary and Trevor, pool and where it is played serves a much more vital purpose than just recreation. Pool bars function as their offices, as their relationships, as their connection to the world or their buffers from it. This is an entirely new landscape for me, both physically, dark and small and cramped and dangerous, and psychologically, also dark and small and cramped and dangerous. That landscape can change quickly, which is the other magnet that draws me to pool and to the lives of pool players. Every Monday, when I enter a bar with a pool table in the back, my teammates sprawled on bar stools or slouching near the rack of cues, Liz raising an eyebrow and giving me a nod and a smile as I make my way back toward the inner sanctum, feeling just a little superior as I pass the non-pool-playing patrons. I feel a sense of anticipation, a tingling apprehension. Anything can happen tonight. Anything. Is this the real appeal? Do I secretly want to step into my own downward spiral, sleep with rough trade, become an unwitting participant in shady drug deals, learn how to hustle and cheat and identify marks, make strange late-night calls from payphones to mysterious friends in far-flung places, live my own Elizabeth Wurzel tragi-chique dysfunctional existence until a kindly therapist who bears an uncanny resemblance to Robin Williams or Whoopi Goldberg pulls me out of it? No, I don't think so. I am not an adrenaline junkie, nor do I have a particular desire to associate with bad characters. But the distance between fear and joy is, not surprisingly, quite short, and the journey from one to the other is, more often than not, quite thrilling, no matter which direction you're heading.
That's great. Heather Byard reading from her new memoir, Sweet, an Eight-Ball Odyssey. Alice is calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Alice, you're on the air with Heather Byard.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Heather, I love your book. Absolutely love it.
Thank you.
I was 13, and my best friend Debbie and I wanted to play pool in the pool hall. There was an alley, a pool hall in Jamaica Plain. And we went upstairs, and it was 90 cents to play for half an hour. We put our 90 cents on the counter, and they wouldn't let us play because we were girls. Mm. And so we caused a little ruckus, and we finally ended up, you know, getting the pool sticks. We didn't know what we were doing. They let us play just because they sort of wanted to make fun of us. And I ended up making a lot of money as a teenager playing pool. And they had a citywide competition. And because there were so few girls that played pool, my best friend and I, for 2 years running, ended up as the two final girls that played pool.
Alice, how did it feel then? How did it feel to be the girl player, the female? I mean, you were 13 when you started. What's pool like? We're hearing some from Heather. What's your sense of it for women in the pool hall?
Are you talking to me or Heather?
Yes, Alice, you.
Oh, me. Well, we thought it was great because we were the only girls that played. And so, you know, of course, we started smoking and we had the Coca-Cola there. And Heather, when I'm reading your book and you talk about the focus that you need, it's funny because we certainly needed focus because we didn't know what we were doing. But I loved the socialization. I loved the crowd. I loved the people. You know, I loved, like, the whole atmosphere around trying something that no one had done before, and sort of learning on the fly. And when we made mistakes, we were almost sort of excused for making them because they looked at us like we didn't know what we were doing anyway. It was great. And there was this Minnesota Fats picture of a Minnesota Fats pool table outside the ladies' room. And I used to walk by it every day, and I used to think to myself, one day I'm going to get one of those someday. I am definitely going to get me one of those tables. And that's what I wanted to be. My mother was horrified. She would come up and drag me out of there when I was a kid because I was supposed to be at CCD or something. You know?
The girl wants to be Minnesota Fats, and she loves the book as well. Alice, thanks a lot for that. Heather Beyer, there's a big thumbs up from she who's played since 13. But what was it like for you to be, you weren't there since 13. This was your first step into a pool hall. How did it feel as a woman? We have these images of it being kind of a male domain, potentially a menacing domain to women. On the other hand, maybe women are in the minority and so kind of held up. How did you find the gender realm, lines, atmosphere of the pool hall?
I think when I first started, you're correct. It definitely, there were more men who played, and there was a sort of a male presence that was felt, that something masculine and macho about the pool halls. That
I mean,
was,
the first thing your girlfriend says is, oh, my God, how woefully phallic when you show off your cue.
Right. Yes. That is something that she would say. And it is true. There, of course, there is a sort of sexual innuendo, I think, sometimes to a pool game because of the, you know, the cue stick and the balls and the slowness of it and the buildup. But I think initially, and this sort of relates to what Alice said, I mean, she was very young when she started and sort of, you know, just was able to walk in there and throw the shackles off and insist that they let her play. And I was 30 years old when I walked into a pool hall, and I was used to, at that point, being something of a high achiever. So to be in this realm where I looked like I stood out, you know, I'm a woman, and I'm petite, and I'm polite, and I didn't know what I was doing and was used to doing well at things. And to be sort of awkward and exposed in this completely foreign environment was a bit overwhelming at first. I guess I stuck with it because of the atmosphere that we're talking about, and maybe a little of the menace that you mentioned. As you know, it presented a challenge, and that's what I had, I had spent the last decade and a half doing. But it was a very different challenge, a challenge of a completely different nature. All of my skills at pushing ideas and articulating things over Cobb salads, none of that mattered at all. Once I walked in there, all people want to do is see how you play.
You found some women who were friendly, some who weren't, some who were helpful. You're a good reader, Heather. I wish you'd read a bit more for us. On page 170, you take us into back to the pool hall and a little woman from England who taught you something about pool.
Yes. The sound of a rack of balls being broken by a wooden stick is instantly recognizable. It's angry and thrilling and shocking. It announces you and the kind of game you play as if through a bullhorn. You're startling someone, taking momentum from him before he takes it from you, a longtime league player says to me not long after I joined Sam's team. It's like mugging a mugger. He makes this statement while observing his teammate turn a neat triangle of balls into a thunderous starburst, and then watches the opposing player's eyes widen ever so slightly. If breaking a rack of 15 pool balls is a way to turn the tables on a criminal, my break isn't working. Not only isn't it working, it's helping out my would-be assailants. I'm being mugged, robbed, burgled, and carjacked on a weekly basis. My break is the equivalent of throwing a monogrammed silk handkerchief onto the table. It's meek, soft, dainty. More than anything, it's embarrassing. I've never had a lot of power in my arms, but the key to an effective break is in the rest of your body. Your arms are really just there to hold the cue steady. The push from your legs, the thrust from your hips, this is what enables you to stroke powerfully, to send the cue ball barreling through the triangle of balls like a sledgehammer. One Monday evening, I'm shooting a practice game at my new bar with a minuscule woman from England who I know from the pool league. Her break is symphonic. It's also something of a sight gag since she can't weigh more than 95 pounds. And yet sometimes she barrels into the rack so hard that she sends some of the balls flying off the table. Her name is Katya, and at first glance she appears harmless, with a long, blank face, a low voice, and thin, straight, neatly parted hair. It's my turn, and I've just broken the rack. The balls fan lazily into a little bouquet in the center of the table, with the requisite four balls just barely touching the rails. None of them have gone into a pocket. "Do you always break like that?" Katya asks politely. "Yes," I sigh. "It's pathetic, isn't it? Could I give you some pointers?" She speaks in a softly accented voice. I assent immediately. She quietly re-racks, her blouse riding up as she leans over the table to reach the more far-flung balls. She's pale. Her jeans are faded. She has thin lips and small, deep brown eyes that I can't read. She looks at me, then at the table. "Use your hips," she commands. I blink in astonishment. A sly smile plays on her lips. "You've got to use your hips," she says. "Trust me, it will change your life."
And there it is, girlfriend advice in the pool hall. And it works. It works for you. It's Heather Beyer reading from her new memoir, Sweet, An Eight-Ball Odyssey. Let's take a call from Providence, Rhode Island. Paula, you're on the air with Heather.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I wanted to ask Heather about, I play a sport that involves a lot of noise as well. I'm a college professor, but I bowl. And I bowl in a couple of different leagues, and it's, for me, what's interesting in that double life is the class difference. And I found initially there was some suspicion among other bowlers about me, because bowling is a kind of working class world. And I wonder if Heather found that in the pool hall.
It's a good question, Paula. Heather, what do you say?
That's an excellent question. I would say, and I remark on this in the book, that one of the things that appealed to me so much about pool was that that people from different backgrounds mixed so easily in this environment, and that there was something about the ranking system in the league that I played in that was so egalitarian that what you did or where you were from or who you were just didn't matter.
You are what you play.
I'm sorry?
You are what you play, in a
exactly,
way.
Exactly, exactly. Yes, perfectly put. And I think that when I first started playing, in fact, there's a scene in the book where I talk about this, there was a lot of good-natured ribbing and abuse. Everyone had to endure it. And I was teased a lot because of my vocabulary, because of some of the observations I would make or the things I would say. And
a little too fancified sometimes?
Right, exactly. And so the way it was handled was that I was just teased. And in a way, that was the thing that made me feel accepted when I started getting teased for things like that. And of course, I could tease back. And so it was one of those things that was noticed, but it was not, it didn't dominate at all. And I remember being a little nervous about that because, yeah, I was meeting people in New York that I was not meeting in, the corporate halls that I stalked during the week or at these, restaurants where you'd pay $18 for, a sandwich with a lot of arugula in it. And, this was a very different world. But people didn't ask a lot of questions about what you did outside of pool. Mm. When you were there, all that mattered was pool, maybe what was on the jukebox, the kind of beer you were drinking, and, if you were any good, what kind of evening you were having.
Mm. Heather Beyer, we decided in advance not to entirely take your word for that and put out a call to one of your former teammates in New York, a longtime pool hall veteran, captain of a pool team on which you played. He joins us now from New York, Joe Rizzo. Joe, are you there, my friend?
Yes, I am, Tom.
Thanks a lot for being with us, Joe. I don't know if you've read the book yet. Heather describes you as cunning and delicate and mysterious in your namesake in the book. Joe, what did you make of Heather coming in from her, 9-to-5 job when she showed up playing pool in your hall?
Well, she was probably the most different person that ever played on any of my teams.
What do you mean by different, Joe Rizzo?
Well, she started off by walking in one day out of the clear blue sky, the second week of a brand new season, and she just came up to me and said, "I play pool. Do you have a room on your team?"
Is that weird?
That's very weird. Usually people try to figure out where they want to play a couple of months ahead of time. And Heather was just kind of making the rounds around, walking around looking for a team.
Your team is called, I love this name, Scrubby's Dead. Scrubby is dead. What's the I don't know, do you have a sort of a team attitude, Joe? Did Heather fit into it?
Yes, she did immediately. We started talking, and I base my team more on personalities than on whether you're a really good pool player or not.
Now, why is that? Don't you want to win?
Well, we win better when we all get along.
Mm-hmm.
If we all have similar personalities, like Heather said, teasing each other, being able to just say whatever you want to each other without feeling, am I upsetting her? Is she going to take this the wrong way? That's more important because that keeps the whole team together, and then we play better as a team and we win.
That's great. Wherever people come from. Heather, what did you make of Joe and Scrubby's Dead?
Well, when Joe was pointed out to me as the captain, the person I needed to talk to, he appeared wearing his trademark black T-shirt, black leather vest, black jeans, and had his Guinness beer lined up, several glasses on the bar table. And I wasn't sure at first. He looked a little dangerous, but as soon as he smiled and started talking, I realized that he was very kind and very warm. And he really surprised me. I had been to a couple of other bars and had not gotten the same response. And his response instantly, he just started asking me questions and was actually ready to play me that very night. it was very quick. He obviously sized me up very quickly. He's gotten very good at doing that. And I was surprised. He actually caught me unawares because I didn't think that I thought I would have to go into some whole preamble about
right.
why I wanted to
please,
play.
Please, please, please. Joe, let me ask you. We're hearing what Heather found in the pool hall. You've been there playing a long time. What does it do for you? What do you find there? What do you take from it, Joe?
It's to me, it's my escape from the real world. It's where I go to have fun. It's where my friends are. It's where working doesn't really matter because you're playing pool, and whether you win or lose, you're still having fun. You can always put your name back up on the board and play again, so it's not a matter of I have to win, otherwise people won't talk to me or they won't treat me the same way. It's playing the game and having fun and talking to everybody. And it is a dual life. It's just getting away from everything that you do on a daily basis and having a lot of fun and just enjoying yourself.
Mm. And sometimes he's got to have it or she's got to have it. Joe Rizzo, it's great having you with us. Captain of Scrubby's Dead, the pool team in New York. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us this hour.
In my pleasure.
Tom's calling from Boston. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good morning, Mr. Ashbrook.
Hello, sir.
I find this conversation very salient. I used to, how should I say, ply my trade in the pool business. And some of the things are interesting, especially with the woman coming in. When I was younger, I personally used to welcome women coming in because I figured that added 50% more of the action. And I was
hey, Tom, what does ply your trade in the pool business mean exactly?
I'm probably one of those characters that she means that, like, waits for people to come in or goes to pool rooms looking for people to play for, well, lucre. You know,
to hustle.
Money. Well, hey, it's the way to go. But the thing is, you know, you say about finding your groove back, and
yeah.
There's been a demise now of this kind of scene due to the casinos and legalized gambling. I'm down here in Boston. I used to get by pretty well. And now you go into pool rooms and everything, you can't even catch a cold when you get in there. People that used to play it for 50 or 100 or something, if they play it for 5 or 10, they're not even there. All the card players have disappeared, the people that play dice, flip quarters, all that bit, and everything.
Everybody's off at the casino. Are you saying that the crowd is gone or just the suckers, the money marks?
The action. Pool was really about action. You know, I'm about 50, and when I, as a kid, the reason I got into the pool was there was an all-night place. You know, that was the only thing that was all-night in Boston at that time. And back then, people such as Boston Shorty, even Minnesota Fats, Larry Liscotti, all those kind of people would come in through and gamble and things like that. And, you know, if you were willing to play with them, especially when you were young, back then you could play them for $5, $10. You learned a lot quick. And the quickest way to learn was to play for money.
Tom, we hear it. Let's take it to Heather. Heather, Tom says the action's moved on. What do you say?
Well, I would say the kind of action that he's describing, it's possible that that has moved on, the stake horses, the hustling, that sort of thing. I think that one thing that has happened with pool halls, certainly in New York, is that a lot of them are being made a little more upscale, and they're trying to appeal to a different crowd and even be made more family-friendly, so that you can go there and play pool, or you can bring the kids and have a birthday party and play air hockey or ping pong. I have definitely seen that happen at a lot of pool halls. And if you're having kids' birthday parties there, you're not going to get a lot of action under the table. That's definitely true. For me, when I play pool in New York, if I go to a pool bar, I often have to wait to get on the table. And likewise at the pool hall. In fact, just last night I was at Amsterdam Billiards, New York City, at 11th Street and 4th Avenue, and there was a long wait for a table. Part of it was because a lot of the regulars were there practicing, and part of it was because I think there was an investment bank that was having a corporate event there.
And you're not talking for dinner. You're talking a table to play some pool. Heather, let me get another call in here, if I may, from Milford, Connecticut. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah.
This is Pat. My question is, about the past year and a half, I was overseas, and that's when I got into playing pool a little more seriously, for fun, but still a little more seriously.
Where were you, Pat?
Now that I'm, I was in China.
Okay. Oh, okay. That's a place to get in the pool these days, I guess.
It was interesting. I met a lot of great people. My question is, now that I'm back in the States and in Connecticut, I'm really trying hard to get my wife interested in pool. Any suggestions besides, of course, having her read your book? questions?
How to woo her in there. Let's put it to Heather. Yeah, Heather, what do you say?
Well, I would find out, I would find out what her resistance is, because I think a lot of people resist doing things where they think they're going to look foolish, and that was a big obstacle for me. It took me 5 years to walk into a pool hall and ask somebody if they could teach me how to do it, and it was because I thought I would look like an idiot. And I definitely did at certain points in the beginning, but I think it's one of those games that you might be able to surprise yourself, and the most unexpected people turn out to be very good at it. And I don't think you have to have any kind of particular athletic prowess or special superpowers to be good at pool. So I would, if that's part of her resistance, it's also, what we were talking about earlier about pool's sociability. It's certainly a fun evening. You know, most places when you go to play pool, there's music playing. You get all charged, whether it's from Joan Jett or something else. You can have a drink. You can watch other people. The other games are quite mesmerizing. And, with me and as I said, sort of creating this alternate persona, I always, I would sort of like dress the part. I thought it was fun to, wear something different than I would normally wear. And I don't know, I would use that approach, that it can be an evening like you've never had before.
No kidding, the way you describe it, finding a lot there, another persona, maybe a little love beyond the bar, a whole lot going on. You know, you say it doesn't take superpower status necessarily, but sometimes it does. And I want to turn to one of the women who's, well, in fact, she is at the very top of the American pyramid of pool players on your side of the gender line, Heather. And it's great when Monica Webb joins us right now from Douglasville, outside Atlanta. She's known as the Assassin. She is the number one ranked American on the professional pool tour. Monica Webb, we're honored to have you. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Hi, Heather.
Hi there.
So you are number one in the entire country, and this at a time when women's professional pool is going pretty great guns. Monica, what's driving the popularity?
It's going great. I'm proud to say, I was listening in earlier on the guy that called in about, pool is kind of changing from the smoky pool room and hustling and gambling. And the women, I feel, are the people that are, the women's tour are the ones that is leading that front. That's been our goal from day one, to take it from that and make it a much more, just a more mainstream sport where, you can take a date, women feel comfortable to go into the pool room and play in local leagues. And the number of people that play pool every year is I mean, staggering. Where last I checked, it was top five in most participated sports, and that's all sports. That's golf included. So.
And you, well, right at the very top of that on the women's side, you just got back from Kosovo performing for the troops there. What, your dad opened a pool hall when you were 8 or 9 years old. You've been playing ever since then. And you've said, Monica, that there's a lot here. There's some advantages to being a woman in this world because there are tricks of the trade almost too subtle to write up, but men may be more willing to share them with a woman than with a male competitor. What do you say?
Yes, absolutely. I'm friends with most all the top male professionals, and they offer up information and certain secrets to pool to me where they probably wouldn't their male counterparts or do it so readily. It's an advantage. You know, I feel grateful to get any type of knowledge from any great player. You know, I'll take it when I can get it, you know, so... And women didn't even used to be allowed in the pool room, so it's really been the men that have held a lot of the knowledge, but that's changed dramatically now.
Heather, having read your book, having the number one player in the country on must be something. I mean, you've seen it down in the weeds where people are fighting and scrapping for every little advance in the rankings, but a long way from the top of the pyramid. Can you imagine what it takes to be the best woman pool player in America?
I really can't. I mean, I know I have seen professional matches in person a couple of times, and the first time that I did, I realized that the distance between what a professional like Monica Webb could do on the table and what I could do on the table was a distance so vast it could never be traversed. it's incredible to see these people play and what they can do and one of the things I remember noticing when you see a pool game and you sort of expect it to be full of trick shots and crazy banks, and it's always fun to watch that. But that's usually what the person is doing when they're losing. And what I noticed when I have seen the women playing on ESPN and the games I've seen in person is they make it look so easy. It looks every shot ends up perfectly, and it's just a series of seemingly easy shots because they have such control over the ball that it always ends up in the perfect place. Mm-hmm. So they don't often have to do all that fancy stuff. And it was very eye-opening to me to see that.
Let's listen to just a little bit here of a sports TV anchor calling another pro, Julie Kelly's game on the professional circuit.
Oh, how did she hit it?
Whoa.
Oh, wow. What a shot to come with for the match. Look out, cue ball. Look out, cue ball.
Look out, cue ball. Monica, that's your world. You're in a tournament nearly, what, every month these days?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
And what kind of training do you do to stay in shape pool-wise to do that?
Well, outside of practicing every day for, you know, hours and hours, I do physical training in the gym. I do an extensive amount of mental training. I read mental training books.
What's the mental training for pool? What do you have to when you go to the mental training side of it?
I think pool has got to be the most mental game out there. You have all the time in the world to think negatively and to you have to visualize each shot. You can visualize yourself missing it, or you can visualize yourself making it. And sometimes when the pressure is on, just like a pitcher in baseball, he has a lot of time to think about negativity. So it can creep into the mind, and you have to really chase that away, and you have to practice that. You actually have to work on doing that before you become good at it, where you can perform well under pressure. And it's a different level, you know. It's
well, I'm
definitely...
sure. I'm sure. When you watch professional golfers, listening to that little bit of the TV coverage, it made me think of golf. When you watch Michelle Wee or Annika Sorenstam playing golf, do you feel a kinship with them, you know, out on a different kind of green, Monica?
I know. I can imagine what they're thinking in their head. You definitely want to try to do the same routine mentally as well as physically approaching your shot every single time. And what that does is help eliminate any bad habits under pressure to come out or any negative thoughts to creep in. And that's what they're basically are doing. And people that play baseball, when they step up to the mound, you see they do the same thing every time. It's the same thing, so...
Kinship, you know, right across the sporting lines. Our time is growing short, but Monica Webb, it's an honor to have you, the number one ranked women's pro tour pool player in the country, The Assassin.
Wonderful being with you guys. And Heather, I wish you the best of luck on your book. I'm going to go out and buy it today.
What's your advice to Heather as she goes on down her young pool career, Monica?
Continue having fun. I think she knows her stuff already. I don't know if there's any advice I can give her except for, continue having fun. And if you do that, you'll get better. And pool is a great sport for anybody that, wants to play, young and old and good or bad. And it's fun no matter what.
Well, you're at the top. Monica Webb, number one in America. Thanks for being with us. Let's take a call from Stephen in Boston. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I appreciate it. And Heather, I agree with virtually everything you've said about the game and the allure and the romance and the way it takes you out of your everyday life. I'm sure that I'm not alone when I say that I got into billiards when I was in college. I'd like to say that dropping out of college for me was not an event. It was a process, and it happened in the game room.
The pool took you right off the rails there. Do you regret it, Stephen, or not?
Well, no. College was not really in my game plan anyway. As a matter of fact, the interesting thing about billiards is that I ended up restoring antique billiards tables for a living.
you really went to ground with it. Our time is so short, but we love that story. Let me get one more. Rob in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Rob, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking the call, Tom.
Yeah.
Heather, can't wait to read your book. This is the first I've heard about it today. Just wanted to share my story of how I got a relationship with the game. My grandfather had a table when he retired, and we'd go there for the weekend and stuff, and it was a respite for me, kind of like you've described. I was about 12, 13 years old, and I would put on his hi-fi his Toscanini recording of all the Beethoven symphonies, one after another.
Were you a musician? Are you, Rob, a musician?
I'm a cellist, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's how I kind of got into it, was I just stay up all night playing straight pool and nine ball and eight ball with myself and listening to Toscanini make his way through Beethoven.
So. That's a great image. I love it.
Pretty different from the pool hall thing.
You can write it in lots of directions. Rob, thanks for your call. Heather, what about you? You talk about the alternate persona that you developed, cultivated in the pool hall. Where did it take you? What is it? What's the second life it's given you?
I think it has allowed me to tap into a part of myself that is less verbal and analytical and always having to examine everything and figure it out and learn how I can excel as a way to enjoy. And it's more intuitive and more physical, and it plays a little, I guess, to my dramatic side, the side that is not crisp and does not feel that she always has to say the perfect thing and achieve, at her job, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's when my persona when I would play pool was very quiet at first sort of meditative as I was taking everything in. And I tapped into a completely different part of myself, as I said, the more intuitive part.
And when you sit in the corporate mm-hmm. meeting now at work, looking at your work colleagues there in the office, do you find yourself thinking, there's another world out there, folks?
Oh, sure. Yes, I do. When I'm not thinking, oh, yeah, I could take you. yes, I do think that sometimes. And in fact, it gives me some relief if I'm sitting in some, endlessly long meeting and listening to people drone on, I do think about that. And I think this is just one part of me. This is just what I do during the day. This isn't necessarily who I am. And I absolutely think that what you described and that if they only knew, and some of them do, and I think they're intrigued and maybe a little envious.
Mm. Well, they'll all know it now if they care to. The new memoir is Sweet, an 8-Ball Odyssey. Heather Beyer has joined us from New York. Heather, it's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you. Thank
really
you very
fun.
Much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.